Hello, I'm Kevin Keith. In this episode of Skeptical Ethics, we'll look at the ways moral issues play out in practical policymaking and how that intersects with classical skepticism. Before we start, let me remind listeners that the Skeptical Ethics series attempts to apply skeptical reasoning to value-based issues such as moral or cultural controversies. New listeners, or those who want to review the basic conceptual grounding of that enterprise, may wish to download the first Skeptical Ethics segment, Does Skepticism Lead to Agreement?, which appeared in Episode 2 of the Skeptical Connections podcast, and the second segment, Moral Agreement Among Skeptics, from Episode 3 of Skeptical Connections, for useful background. As skeptics, we want important public issues to be resolved rationally, with attention to empirical facts and confirmed science. The distortion of controversies over evolution, global warming, abortion, and other issues by the denial of scientific fact, and often the deliberate introduction of falsehood and discredited factual inaccuracies, flies in the face of the pursuit of truth and rationality that skepticism valorizes. But practical politics rarely plays out along purely rational lines, and the strength of people's opinions on controversial issues often does not correspond to the degree of their rational defensibility. How should skeptics understand and potentially participate in political activism in a way that respects and employs their own skeptical perspective, but also recognizes the context in which political change occurs? This episode was written the day after historic legal events in the United States led to dramatic evolutions of political controversies that are open to rational analysis, but had not been fought out on rational grounds. One was the issuing of a Supreme Court ruling in a case affecting marriage rights for same-sex couples in California. The other was a hard-fought filibuster in the Texas state legislature that, after hours of effort and complex legislative maneuvering, succeeded in temporarily preserving access to clinics providing abortion service to women in that state. A closer look at these events will illuminate the connection, or lack of connection, between rational analysis and practical political action. Rational persons should ideally have been able to evaluate the arguments for both sides, identify those most strongly grounded on fact and most solidly argued in logical terms, and determine which should prevail. But of course, no one expected the issues would be resolved that way, and they were not. In the oral arguments heard in the Supreme Court case regarding California's Proposition 8, prohibiting same-sex marriage, one issue that arose was whether same-sex marriage is harmful to the children of same-sex couples. Justice Scalia claimed that, quote, "There's considerable disagreement among sociologists as to what the consequences of raising a child in a same-sex family, whether that is harmful to the child or not. Some states do not permit adoption by same-sex couples for that reason," end quote. In fact, there is almost no disagreement on those points. In an amicus brief filed before the oral argument in that very case, the American Sociological Association wrote that, quote, "The claim that same-sex parents produce less positive child outcomes than opposite-sex parents contradicts abundant social science research. Decades of methodologically sound social science research confirm that positive child well-being is the product of stability in the relationship between the two parents, stability in the relationship between the parents and child, and greater parental socioeconomic resources. Whether a child is raised by same-sex or opposite-sex parents has no bearing on a child's well-being. The clear and consistent consensus in the social science profession is that across a wide range of indicators, children fare just as well when they are raised by same-sex parents when compared to children raised by opposite-sex parents," end quote. An official report of the American Academy of Pediatrics from March of this year noted that, quote, "Extensive data available from more than 30 years of research reveal that children raised by gay and lesbian parents have demonstrated resilience with regard to social, psychological, and sexual health despite economic and legal disparities and social stigma. Many studies have demonstrated that children's well-being is affected much more by their relationships with their parents' sense of competence and security, and the presence of social and economic support for the family than by the gender or sexual orientation of their parents. Because marriage strengthens families and in so doing benefits children's development, children should not be deprived of the opportunity for their parents to be married," end quote. This was the third endorsement of same-sex marriage the Academy had issued in the last 10 years. The scene in the Texas legislature was even stranger. Republican legislators had promoted a bill that imposed severe and unprecedented restrictions on the operation of health clinics in Texas that provided abortions. The impact of the bill would have been to force almost 90% of such clinics in the state to shut down completely because the regulations had been written in such a way that they could not be met. The nominal rationale for these restrictions was often said to be to protect women, but it was clear that their actual and obviously intended impact was simply to make abortion care inaccessible and to make it impossible or unaffordable for clinics to comply with regulations and thus deny patients care at those clinics by forcing them out of business. The fact that all of these regulations flatly contradicted accepted safe medical practice was evidence enough that their supposed rationale was a sham. When bills containing these restrictions did not pass in the regular legislative session, the governor of Texas called a special legislative session devoted to passing all these restrictions as a single bill. Debate and parliamentary maneuvering delayed passage until the final day of the session, when a lone legislator, State Senator Wendy Davis, staged a 13-hour filibuster to prevent passage before the midnight deadline. Republican legislators used repeated instances of highly dubious procedural maneuvers to break the filibuster. Each one was sustained by the Republican chair of the session or by the Republican majority on a party-line vote. In response, Democratic legislators used procedural moves to delay voting for the final 90 minutes of the session, and when the necessary votes were finally forced through, raucous cheering and screaming by hundreds of reproductive rights activists in the chamber gallery made it impossible for voting to continue through the final 15 minutes of the session. The final vote took place 2 minutes after the midnight deadline. Republicans attempted to change the timestamp on the official vote record to make it appear the vote had occurred before midnight. Democrats objected, and finally the bill was declared defeated, the result of 11 hours of nonstop talking, numerous clearly partisan political maneuvers, outright fraud by the Republican majority, and a popular uprising in the Senate chamber itself. None of this, obviously, required or usually even involved reasoned argument. It should be noted again that both these issues, the effect on children of gay marriage and women's safety in abortion treatment, are factual questions that can be resolved by reference to abundant existing empirical evidence, and in the case of the abortion restrictions, also by the fact that the regulations themselves do not conform to normal standards of medical safety. Yet the proponents of one side of each of these debates, including numerous experienced state legislators and even justices of the Supreme Court of the United States, had no compunction about putting forth factual claims that were entirely self-contradictory or contradicted by actual empirical evidence, in some cases evidence that had been formally presented to them in writing long before they made their erroneous claims. Not only were the debates conducted without regard for factual accuracy, but the evident factual falsehood of the major arguments on one side was not decisive in resolving the issues, even when it was clearly documented. Whatever one's opinion on these various controversies may be, it can't be said that they were resolved by rational argumentation supported by empirical evidence. And that's not atypical of how factually grounded issues are often resolved in the political arena. How should skeptics approach this process, then? How should they participate in it? One possibility is to throw up one's hands and declare that politics is hopelessly corrupt, that it is impossible to conduct a rational debate on any topic in the political context, and therefore that the skeptical toolkit is irrelevant, or at best weak, in addressing practical policy. Another possibility is to see argumentation and evidence as part of the process of advocacy, but not decisive in it. It may be useful to have facts at one's fingertips and to counter false claims by political opponents with real evidence, but the less rational tools of politics, such as soundbites, slogans, rallies, and appeals to the base voters, are also important and possibly more significant in a practical way. A final possibility is to regard evidence as meaningless, or at best another form of slogan or rallying tool. In this view, the only thing that matters is to acquire the leverage to sway the voting public or the legislative process in order to achieve one's goals. How that is done is irrelevant, and whether a given statement or position is true or false is also irrelevant, in contrast to the question whether it works or not. All these possibilities seem bleak from a skeptical point of view. Skeptics, I think, like to think of skepticism as a tool for change, or for the enlightenment that is required for change. Once one sees the truth about a situation in a rational way, grounded on empirical evidence, one can then make appropriate decisions about that thing, and those decisions will be more correct than ones grounded on superstition, intuitions, or parochial values, or blind tradition. The idea that factual evidence and logical analysis, actually in hand and properly understood, would be irrelevant to policymaking, or would be ignored or misconstrued even when they had already been documented and presented to the disputants, seems not merely counterproductive, but destructive of skepticism and rationality itself. But the empirical evidence about the insignificance of empirical evidence in practical discourse seems undeniable. Using one's skeptical tools to make a positive contribution to one's own society is a great and high goal of skepticism, one that motivates many skeptics, I suspect. That goal is elusive, however. Coming to terms with that, and choosing the most satisfying and helpful role for one's skepticism, may itself be a frustrating exercise in practical activism. I'd welcome your comments and questions directed to skepticalconnections.com.